This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. The pandemic is over in Texas and Mississippi. Are you over the pandemic? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line. Governor Greg Abbott announcing yesterday.
So today, I'm issuing a new executive order that rescinds most of the earlier executive orders. Effective next Wednesday, all businesses of any type are allowed to open 100%. That includes any type of entity in Texas.
And he also rescinded the mask mandate. Tate Reeves in Mississippi doing the same.
This new order removes all of our county mask mandates and allows businesses to operate at full capacity without state-imposed rules or restrictions.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line.
All I kept thinking, Dan, was the song from Little Texas. Do you know this song? God Bless Texas? Well, I was supposed to start on the frame, but it says God Bless Texas with his own hands.
Yeah, I'm familiar.
Familiar with it.
Yeah. Chicago has some good news too. It's a little bit more tempered as compared to what's coming out of many other states now. Just Texas and Mississippi added to the list. Effective immediately, indoor capacity at bars, restaurants, and other businesses can increase to 50%. Bars and restaurants can now remain open until 1 a.m. Alcohol sales from liquor stores and other establishments with a packaged good license can now continue until 11 p.m. And indoor fitness class size can increase to 20 people. Do you have a song for that?
I don't have a song for that, but I'm so excited. We did this over the summer, remember? We prioritized bars and restaurants before we prioritized our children and their schools. And what happened? Then we had to shut everything all back down again. Her priorities are so out of whack. What she should have done yesterday is said, everyone's going back to school because, by the way, we're way below 3% for the positivity rate. And we're going to open up schools and we're going to make Jesse Sharkey and the CTU open up high schools. And then you can worry about your bars. Sorry, I know that's selfish and one-minded, but that's what they did in Europe and it's working fine. And start with the children first and then worry about your bars until 1 a.m.
I mean, do you get the sense, though, even in Chicago and even as they, at a snail's pace, allow businesses to reopen and, as you suggest, in sort of a curious prioritization, do you get the sense that people are beyond this? This is not to say that people are not still going to get sick. There's still not going to be cases. There's still not going to be adverse outcomes. But the pandemic and the associated hysteria and the support for the lockdowns, all of that is at minimum on the wane, even in the most fear-addled, deferential to government places in the country like Chicago. Do you get the sense that that's the trajectory?
Yes. I mean, this whole thing, I'm over it. I'm ready to go down. I'm ready to get arrested for not wearing a mask. Because, Dan, what I'm going to do, I'm going to identify as a Texan. Because I used to live in Texas, so no, I am a Texan, so therefore I'm not required to wear a mask.
You're governed by Texas law no
right.
matter where you
no
are.
No matter where I'm. That's my thing. That's my allegiance to Texas. Well, you know, if I can identify as a dude and use a boys' washroom or the men's washroom, why can't I identify as a Texan and just not wear a mask?
I suppose that logic is impenetrable, yes. Mary Kay in Western Springs here on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Oh, gosh, you guys, I my heart, you know, my second cup of coffee, my heart feels like it's going to pound out of my chest every morning, but that's because of you guys, but thank you. I'm out of business. I can't run, I can't do fitness anymore. I had to go a whole different direction thanks to these jerks, and You know, I work with people over 50. Those are the people who will never come back to the gym. Many, many of them, they never will get back in the water and exercise with me in the water. These old people who need it more than anybody else. What in God's name, why are we so slow on the uptake? I mean, I'm slow on the uptake, you guys. I can't think as fast as I used to, but these are the people in charge. I just, oh, Amy, Dan, I can't believe we are where we are. Yeah.
Celebrating?
I'm going to identify. What can I identify as?
You can be a Texan, too. It's a big state. Just go around and say, hee-haw.
I don't know where to be. Mississippi, did you say they're open, Dan?
Yes, they're open, too. Yes,
they're open today, 100%.
Thanks for the call, Mary Kay. Appreciate it. Yeah, and this against the backdrop of the announcement, too, which I would think would get people, you know, thinking about being on the other side of lockdown policies. Maybe not in Chicago, I don't know. But the announcement that all adults who want to be vaccinated should be vaccinated by the end of May. That's from the Biden administration.
Oh, yeah. They made the big announcement yesterday. And we're supposed to celebrate this, too. No, it is good.
About 3 weeks ago, we were able to say that we'll have enough vaccine supply for adults by the end of July. And I'm pleased to announce today, as a consequence of the stepped-up process that I've ordered and just outlined, this country will have enough vaccine supply, I'll say it again, for every adult in America by the end of May. By the end of May. That's progress.
Well, it was inevitable progress and has little to do with him, but it is good to see, for example, Merck throwing in with J&J to produce the J&J vaccine and get more of that to market faster.
Yeah, and they're going to have the Defense Production Act, and you know, facilities are going to be operating 24/7, so we're going to have a lot more vaccines. The United Center opens up tomorrow. They're going to be handing out 110 vaccinations for the elderly, but I don't know why not they're not using the J&J vaccine. Why make elderly people go to the United Center twice? Because NBC was reporting that they're going to use a Pfizer and Moderna. So, I mean, if anything, if we get the J&Js, we should not. Because it's, you know, Dan, you've got a father, and it takes a lot for them to get to one location. Why make them go back 3 weeks later?
Yeah, there's also this other, not to go too far on a tangent here, but there's also this other issue, too. By the way, the central planning in vaccine distribution and, frankly, vaccine approval has does not deserve an A grade. Let me just say that. There continues to be real-world data that is piling up from vaccine recipients in Israel and Scotland and England that's very supportive of first doses first, number one, so not holding back second doses and trying to match it up. Just get first doses, get jabs in arms. And also to approve AstraZeneca. The AstraZeneca vaccine has not been approved by the FDA. You could say the FDA is not following the science.
Oh,
and there's no reason that AstraZeneca shouldn't be online in this country as well, and that just provides more supply lines to get more people vaccinated more quickly, even in incompetent states like Illinois, where 77-year-old dads of Dan Proft and 83-year-old dads of at least one of our listeners can't seem to get scheduled, even though R. Kelly and many of his fellow inmates have gotten both doses of the Pfizer or Moderna vaccines at this juncture.
And that's nauseating. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. But with the reopening, though, of Texas and Mississippi, the CDC director had to come out yesterday, Dan, and say, whoa, 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 don't do this.
I am really worried about reports that more states are rolling back the exact public health measures we have recommended to protect people from COVID-19.
Oh, my God. Yeah, well, worry all you want.
Except here's the thing.
Give us choice.
Yeah, I mean, I could bore people by going through it all again. I can send you and I can tweet out all of the studies and the look-sees at the efficacy of lockdown policies in controlling the virus I'm talking about now. Forget businesses. Forget your individual, just in terms of the efficacy in stopping the spread, in eliminating adverse outcomes, both with respect to masks as with respect to lockdown policies more generally. There's quite a lot of scholarship now that has been amassed. Some of it is dubious with respect to mask wearing. A lot of it is fairly clear with respect to lockdowns. And in both cases, it doesn't support the concern of the CDC director. I'm sorry. and it doesn't support the continued fear-mongering of politicians and their acolytes, the lockdown politicians and their acolytes either. I'm sorry. So, this is all at this stage, we're really at the point where this is about forget what politicians and TV doctors and their functionaries and the fear mongers for profit and the COVID enthusiasts have to say. The question is, where is the zeitgeist among the populace? Are you ready to resume your regularly scheduled pre-pandemic lives, or are you still sort of beset by fear? You know, where are we in the population generally? And obviously that's going to vary from community to community and state by state, but I'm just trying to get a sense of what you think based on where your social circle, you know, your circles of influence are currently positioned. Nick in Des Moines, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
I was going to start by saying that, you know, I think the vaccine rollout's been great. That being said, it could be a lot better if we just, like, acknowledge the fact that just one of these vaccines is quite adequate, and you don't really need a second one immediately 4 weeks later. They don't do that in the UK, and things seem to be going quite well over there. But otherwise, I think it's also really important that once you get vaccinated, you don't wear your mask, and you go on with your life as it was before all this happened. And I'm not just saying that. There are lots and lots of physicians and scientists and doctors who are saying that too. Of course, when they say that, you know, the media get into overdrive over how irresponsible that is, even though these people are often quite left-leaning people themselves, and they understand how ridiculous this all is.
That's right.
No, there's COVID enthusiasts out there who love this, who are wearing 2-3 masks. Like, they don't want this to end.
On the vaccine rollout piece, it's been effective in some places and less effective in others. So an important takeaway here from this entire pandemic is central planning is man's folly. And so, yes, this is where when you defer to those who have supply chains and relationships in the marketplace for the distribution and the dissemination of the vaccines, like West Virginia, you can outperform all of the cosmopolitan deep thinkers in a place like New York, which is exactly what's happened with the vaccine rollout. That is a key takeaway from all of this. Jim in Crown Point.
You know, what's interesting with all this, everybody going to the doctor to see if they have the COVID virus, wouldn't it have been a great idea to chart what everybody did have other than the COVID virus? That would have been great information. That might be a correlation between the virus and the disease and the other diseases. And they say there was much flu. How do you know that they didn't mix the flu numbers in with the COVID numbers?
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Get your tickets for Biden, the first 100 days on March 20th. Tickets are on sale now at 560theanswer.com/Biden.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Nipple studs is getting stripped. Amy?
What do you mean?
He probably likes it. Generally speaking, he'd like it getting stripped, but probably not in this way. Yeah, a party nips, the governor there of New York State, is losing the emergency powers that he was granted during the scandal. All of a sudden, the assembly, state assembly in New York woke up, and the Democrats in charge of that assembly, that legislative body, announced yesterday they have reached an agreement to strip.
Ew, why would they use the word strip? But okay. Take his powers away?
That's right. Strip the emergency powers he was given during the pandemic. Listen to this statement from Senate Majority Leader, the Senate Majority Leader in New York. I think everyone understands where we were back in March and where we are now. We certainly see the need for a quick response, but also want to move forward toward a system of increased oversight and review. Oh, do you? The public deserves to have checks and balance, does it?
No, we do.
Our proposal would create a system with increased input while at the same time ensuring New Yorkers continue to be protected. Oh, you've done a bang-up job considering New York is the state that has worst handled by the numbers, by the numbers that COVID enthusiasts like to use for every state other than New York, by the death numbers, by the adverse outcome numbers, by the scandalous numbers with respect to nursing homes and that unfolding.
Death capital of the world.
And the investigation unfolding into that. That's exactly right, certainly of the Western world. But the assembly in New York is reasserting itself against party nips. What? And by the way, do you think, I wonder if JB has nipple rings.
Oh, ew.
I want you to think about that for the rest of the morning.
I'm not going
to
look, too.
What about our General Assembly? I know we focus a lot of time on Triple Threat and Jelly Belly. What about on your local state legislators in the General Assembly here and their general abdication during all this, Republicans and Democrats alike? Is there going to be any accountability there that you would like to sound off upon and perhaps act upon come 2022? 312-642-5600 turnkey.pro answer line, 64636DA turnkey.pro text line.
What do you want to see happen, Dan?
All the politicians in Illinois essentially turn the state over to Indiana to manage.
That's a great idea.
Yeah, just continue, since you've already essentially put one foot out the door in terms of legislation, in terms of your legislative powers, you might as well, as a final act, strip Jelly Belly. And yeah, I want you to think of that image for the rest of the morning, too. Eliminate the state Supreme Court, rescind the Constitution, and just turn the whole enterprise over to the state of Indiana to run. How about that?
I think that sounds great. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment. But I thought, we should really, people need to wake up and focus on who their state rep is, who their state senator is. Contact them. I know.
We've said that for a long time.
And nobody was listening.
On the show. I've said it. I mean, this is why I was so involved with legislative races, wasting my time for about two decades of my life.
You didn't waste your time, Dan.
I did.
No, people appreciate you. Are you kidding me?
I don't think they do, but that's fine. It's not about appreciating me. It's about appreciating individual liberty and common sense and the rule of law and economic opportunity. That's what I wish they'd appreciate. I don't care if they appreciate me or not, but we have very few legislators who do. But it turns out to be really important when, for example, you have a legislative body just turn over their power to the executive and you have one fat man rule over your state, as we've had for the better part of a year in Illinois, but to no particular response from the public. Think about what it took in New York. It took the combination of this is not just about the nursing home scandal in New York. This is also about obviously all the sexual harassment charges in the direction of party nips. That's what's really put this over the edge, where the assembly feels the need to reassert itself, because you have all these Democrats calling for party nips to resign or be impeached.
Right. But that's what makes up, upsets a lot of people, is because it wasn't the nursing home deaths that were fraudulently recorded. It wasn't 9,000. It was 15,000, maybe even more. It was the fact that he grabbed, that he's inappropriate and he's a scumbag, and grabs people on the face and the lower back when they don't want, to be touched there. That's the problem.
Well, not just fraudulently recorded, the deaths that shouldn't have occurred, because infected nursing home patients shouldn't have been sent back to nursing homes. And it was his decision, not on CDC guidance, to do so. And then he lied about it on top of it. But just if you're not sickened enough by nipple studs, then some classics, some of these comments that he's made in the not so recent past, in the not so distant past recently, are coming to the fore. These are fun. How about this? Cuomo on the concept of foreplay.
Ew, okay. All right.
In politics. These are fun.
I'm ready.
There is a concept in life called foreplay.
Oh.
Oh, you. This is wacky sense of humor.
It starts with hello. How are you today? Everything good? Pleasure to see you. Thank you.
for the state fair and the record attendance in the Expo Center. Oh, by the way, there's something else I wanted to mention. I'll call you in the morning. And I did.
you stop.
So gross.
This is what him talking about. Okay. First, compliment me, congratulate me on something, then make your ask. That's the foreplay, you see. First, be nice to me.
Okay.
And then, you know, I'll
rub my back and I'll rub yours.
I'll give it to you.
okay.
That's essentially what he was saying. Here's Andrew Cuomo. Party nips. Back in April 30th, 2020, by this time, 18,000 New Yorkers were dead from COVID. Having a good old time talking about his eligibility. The Love Gov. Remember those fun days?
You and your brother are on the most wanted list for single ladies in New York City as the most desirable. So I was just wondering if you had any comment about that.
Well, Susan, I did not see that. But now that you raise it, most wanted eligibility. My brother is married. I am not married. Mm-hmm. So I don't think he would qualify as eligible. However, I am eligible.
Ew. Ew.
Oh, is he delightful? You can find... more such leadership advice and example in his best-selling book, American Crisis, Leadership Lessons from the Pandemic by Andrew Cuomo. Pick that up, won't you?
Oh, you should stop publishing that book instead of Dr. Seuss.
This was, you know, that's
he's a cool dude with a loose mood, by the way, but we'll play that in a second.
He's a cool dude with
a loose
mood.
That's what he said. I'm a cool dude.
Hey, I mean, he's a man about town. He's on the scene.
He's on the prowl, Dan.
He also, once upon a time, when there were allegations of sexual harassment by individuals in state government, and he was asked about that, what action he's taking with respect to a culture that where that sort of behavior is ongoing, perhaps condoned, blind eye. He was asked about that, state government, and he bristled at the reporter who questioned him about a culture of sexual harassment in state government in New York. Remember this?
Well, look, you have it going on in journalism.
Yeah, I know.
What are you going to do differently?
But the question is about state government.
Yeah, it's about state government. I could tell you later in great detail about that if you're interested.
No, it's about you and journalism. And it's about you and journalism. And it's about state government. And it's about carpentry.
Is your administration going to do anything differently to maybe be a little bit more
aware? We will have policies in state government, obviously, that affect state government. But I think you missed the point. When you say it's state government, you do a disservice to women, with all due respect, even though you're a woman.
Oh.
It's not government. It's society. It was Harvey Weinstein in the arts industry. It's comedians. It's politicians. It's chefs, right? It's systemic. It's societal. It's not one person in one area.
Exactly. It's politicians like me. It's societal.
It happens at schools. It's in churches. Yeah.
By the way, here's a fun idea. You remember that op-ed from just a couple of weeks ago? Some asshat at the USA Today suggested that 500,000 COVID victims be buried at Mar-a-Lago.
Oh, that's right. Yes.
Yeah. Well, if turnabout being fair play and all, this from Peter Earle over at American Institute for Economic Research. Here's an idea. How about renaming the Governor Mario Cuomo Bridge, which spans from the Hudson spans the Hudson River from Nyack, New York, to Tarrytown. How about renaming that for the nursing home victims?
That's a good idea.
Yeah.
Now
you want to get into that business.
Yeah.
Mike in Plano, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, guys. You mentioned state reps earlier. Mine is David Welter. He's out here in Kendall, Grundy, and LaSalle counties. I've mentioned him to you guys before. He's a friend of Adam Kinzinger, which is bad enough, but his biggest problem is that he's just too reactionary. When Pritzker first initiated the lockdown policies, he was in favor of them. I remember calling him out on his Facebook page over it, and he responded with your usual party line, Politburo stuff about public health and safety, blah, blah, blah. And then he finally came out in favor of ending the lockdowns, I believe around the middle or end of May. But at that point, the damage is already done. And at that time, Pritzker had no reason to listen to Republicans because they were just too weak. So, I mean, and look, he's a nice guy. I believe he endured some personal tragedy. I believe he lost a young son recently. But, you know, in the end, I just don't know if he has a passion for the job. And he's just not a wartime conciliary.
Thanks for the call, Mike. Well, this is what I'm talking about. People who pursued or abdicated in the face of these disastrous lockdown policies need to be held accountable politically.
Yep. They cannot be rewarded for bad behavior and vote them again into office.
By the way,
it's just ridiculous.
Yeah, and have you noticed how many heroes and heroines are no more? It's not just party nips there in New York. Celebrated New Zealand president, Jacinda Ardern. Yeah. New Zealand is on their fourth lockdown.
Oh, come on.
And the natives are getting a little restless. They just locked down again, did a snap lockdown over one case they couldn't contact trace. One case.
One case of a cold.
One case.
And the person's not even hospitalized. Okay. About overreaction.
And so the argument in New Zealand, perhaps a place that is more state-addled than even Chicago, is whether or not people who are not following the rules should be legally punished or just nationally shamed. That's the debate going on in New Zealand, which is the debate that still exists here in some quarters. But the bloom is off the rose for the lockdowners, generally speaking. And I think it's only going to continue to get worse. They had a big spike in popularity because people were afraid, because so much was unknown. Big spike in popularity, all these knee-jerk lockdowners. And they rode that to present day. It's starting to turn. And we suggested it would in most places. And hopefully that accountability will come in elections when these politicians from the local level to the state level to the federal level are up, because it needs to. It needs to if you want to send a message that what they did should never happen again, that you can't have that sort of immediate, evidence-free, draconian response. We'll see.
And, you know, I said Governor Pritzker could be part of the cancel culture. And I met because his family owns the Hyatt Hotels, and they hosted CPAC this past weekend with Trump. Because some people were calling for, you know, boycott of Hyatt Hotels, because how could they dare give him a voice and a platform to spew his hatred? Well, do you think Governor Pritzker will get canceled because of that? Do you think people connected the dots that they own the Hyatt Hotel?
Yeah, I doubt it.
Or as you say, yawn. Nobody cares about him on a national level. It's the strangest thing.
And Matt Schlapp slapped back and said, well, wait a second, you recruited us to come to you to the hotel because, of course, it's such a huge event that it's a moneymaker for the hotel, and hotels struggling during the time when you haven't been able to have conferences and events like that. So, I mean, the whole thing is absurd, but, I mean, absurd is the new norm.
Exactly.
Greg in LaGrange.
Hey, good morning.
Morning.
I think the important thing to remember is, and what I've been doing is I've been talking at my church. I think I've been telling you before about that, Dan and Amy, about how some of these bills that are going through with the police and the education are going to be completely disastrous. And at the national level with this equality stuff is just terrible. I think that's where you start. And I tell my relatives, the younger ones that are here, that just remember who did this to you. I've called my representative, Michael Zaleski. I mean, they've been receptive in taking my call and listening to me, but there's no action. And I don't think there would be, because they tend to be, along the same lines as J.B. Pritzker, our governor. So I think the important thing is that we work at our local levels. And I've learned that from you guys. It's not something that it was the epiphany that came from listening to mostly you guys. And that's where you start, even though the national policies are terrible. One thing I want to ask you, Dan and Amy, I'm reading about this new buyer for the Chicago Tribune. Is there hope there? Is it possible that we can get a real newspaper in this town? Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Greg.
Well, anything's possible.
We'll talk a little bit about the state of journalism later in the show. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
The more you listen, the more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer. Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. FBI Director Christopher Wray was before a Senate Oversight Committee yesterday. There are a number of topics that were tackled that we need to go over. One is the death, particularly of Capitol Police Officer Brian Sicknick. Two is, generally speaking, who knew what when with respect to the prospect of violence occurring on January 6th. Three is accountability at the FBI against the backdrop of the Durham investigation that is ongoing, even though Durham himself has resigned as U.S. attorney. He's still being allowed to complete his investigation per Biden's attorney general, Merrick Garland.
All right.
So there's a number of things here. Why is this important? Well, it's important because it's important for a lot of reasons. But in terms of everything January 6th related, especially Officer Sicknick's death, combined with who knew what when in the run-up to January 6th. Why is this important? Because, do not forget this, the left is trying to use what happened on January 6th to eliminate conservatives and Trump voters from the public arena. Eliminate. Not marginalize, not silence, not fold into the state. Eliminate. This is about a pathway to Democrat socialist dominance of whatever it is left that they don't dominate, including the space between your ears. I'm serious. And if you don't believe me, I give my Exhibit A. Our very own Senator Sacca Durbin.
I join my Republican colleagues unequivocally in condemning left-wing violence, but let's stop pretending that the threat of Antifa is equivalent to the white supremacist threat. Vandalizing a federal courthouse in Portland is a crime. It should be prosecuted to the full extent of the law, but it is not equivalent to a violent attempt to overturn the results of elections, nor is it equivalent to mass shootings targeting minority communities. This false equivalency is an insult to the brave police officers who were injured or lost their lives on January 6th, as well as dozens of others who've been murdered in white supremacist attacks. We need to be abundantly clear that the white supremacists and other extremists are the most significant domestic terrorism threat facing the United States today. I hope everyone in this room can look at the facts and acknowledge this, and we can come together on a bipartisan basis to defeat this threat.
Yeah, it's always on a bipartisan basis because Sacca Durbin is so reasonable, right? Saying unreasonable things in a reasonable tone of voice, he's the master of that. Well, according to the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, which is a left-wing organization, the domestic extremist-related killings in the U.S. by year. In 2019, 42. All. Everything classified as a domestic extremist-related killing, 42. Even if they were all of a white supremacist variety, that a white supremacist was culpable for all 42 of those murders, that's a terrible thing. But in context, 42 murders is two bad weekends in Chicago. Isn't it?
That's actually a good weekend in Chicago, yeah.
Well, you know what I'm saying in terms right. of violence? So the rank order prioritization of threats to people's lives and liberties. The attempt here is to say that January 6th and the rioting that occurred by a few hundred knuckleheads.
Bozos. I mean, absolute clowns.
Is representative of a ever-present threat to people's lives and liberty and liberties, particularly those lives and liberties of minorities throughout the country as a whole. An ever-present threat. 42, according to the ADL, and they were not of all of at the hands of white supremacists, but again, for the sake of argument, say they were. 42 in a nation of 330 million people where you have some 7,500 murders a year. Really? An attempt to label all conservatives with the insurrectionist moniker, with the white supremacist appellation. That's what's going on here.
Well, that's what the left does.
And you better understand it and push back on it, which is why we've said from the beginning, you better explain what happened to on January 6th over and over again and not allow that, you know, middling talk about false equivalence. Of course, Sack of Durbin is projecting the false equivalence is to compare the rioting and destruction on January 6th to the ongoing rioting and destruction by Antifa. It was more than just a courthouse in Portland, as well as everything associated with Black Lives Matter over the summer into the fall, and will happen again.
Well, yeah, we had more than 20 people killed in those riots. Remember the innocent bystander in Dubuque, Iowa, who just went down to a you know, George Floyd protest and she got shot in the chest? I mean, a lot of people died, and there's no anger over that, but there's anger over this.
Yeah, the idea that Sack of Durbin or any of the Democrat socialists have spoken with moral clarity when it comes to politically inspired violence or the predicate for lawlessness, the political predicate for lawlessness, even when the real reason for it has nothing to do with politics and is just taking the opportunity to steal or to engage in violence. The idea that people like Sack of Durbin have spoken with moral clarity on that is a lie. Straight away lie. And it is the propagandizing in an effort to, as I said again, and I will continue to beat this drum, to eliminate people who think differently from any participation in this representative republic. And nothing short of that. Nothing short of it.
312-642-5600. Turnkey.pro answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
Now, Christopher Wray is really a frustrating figure, as so many of these higher-ups in government, both sides, or regardless of administration, are. Here is the exchange between Senator Grassley and FBI Director Wray on the issue of the cause of Brian Sicknick's death. Because, of course, this story has been reported recklessly as coming at the hands of one of the rioters. First, and by the way, misidentified. Remember, we had a Chicagoan who was misidentified as the guy who struck Brian Sicknick with a fire extinguisher. He wasn't even there. And now, we're more and more, it looks like there was no guy with no fire extinguisher and there was nobody who struck Brian Sicknick at all.
Right. And his family came forward and said he had a blood clot and then stroked out.
Well,
and so they were a little confused by what was going on.
Well, Christopher Wray was asked if, you know, here we are almost 2 months later, has the FBI concluded cause of death?
There's been conflicting reports about his cause of death. Have you determined the exact cause of death? And is there a homicide investigation?
So I'll take the last part of your question first. There is an ongoing investigation into his death. I have to be careful at this age, because it's ongoing, not to get out in front of it. But I certainly understand and respect and appreciate the keen interest in what happened to him. After all, he was here protecting all of you. And as soon as there are information that we can appropriately share, we want to be able to do that. But at the moment, the investigation is still ongoing.
So does that mean, since the investigation is going on, you have not determined the exact cause of the death?
That means we can't yet disclose a cause of death at this stage.
But you have determined the cause of death.
I didn't say that. We're not at a point where we can disclose or confirm a cause of death.
How long does it take?
What the heck? Are you kidding me? It doesn't take. It's obvious.
Ken Sicknick, his brother, said, this is reporting back in January, that he, meaning his brother Brian, texted him on the night of the riots. He texted me last night. He said this the day after. He texted me last night, the night of the riots. The night of the riots. He texted me last night and said, I got pepper sprayed twice, and he was in good shape. Quote, unquote. Ken
Sicknick. He didn't mention anything about a fire extinguisher.
Let me finish. Apparently, he collapsed in the Capitol, and they resuscitated him using CPR. That's what Ken Sicknick said. The day after that text exchange, the family got word that Sicknick had a blood clot and he had had a stroke. A ventilator was keeping him alive. He died 2 days after the riots, around 9:30 p.m., according to the Capitol Police. So 2 months later, you still can't confirm what Ken Sicknick said 2 days after the riots? I don't understand.
Well, typically, if they do toxicology reports and that, I mean, it's normally 90 days, but some cases that are more complex take longer than that. I mean, I'm still waiting for some autopsy reports from when I worked back at Channel 5.
Yeah.
The information they don't want you to know, they're going to try and hide it and prolong it from you as long as possible.
This is the FBI investigating the single death of a Capitol police officer that is of national import.
Well, how are they going to walk it back if they find out the truth? I mean, he was, you know, in the rotunda. His coffin was visited by many, you know, politicians, even President Biden and his wife Jill. It's just
That's apparently the calculus. How are we going to walk it back? How are we going to obfuscate the truth? How are we going to cover our asses? That's apparently the calculus.
I mean, the coroner did say there is no blunt trauma to the head.
He was asked specifically by Grassley, is this still a murder investigation? And he just gave the vanilla answer that you expect from political hacks like Christopher Wray, who I think has increasingly persuaded the nation that he is nothing more than a political hack.
He needs to go.
Yeah. Well, he's not going to go. There's a reason that he was held over.
But there's no, you're not kind of pregnant. It's either a homicide investigation or there's not.
One more topic area, and then we'll take some of your calls. This exchange between John Kennedy, Senator from Louisiana, and Ray, on the topic of what agency and law enforcement officials knew, when they knew it, and what decisions they made about it. And you get no more clarity from Ray on this topic than you get on the topic of Brian Sicknick's death. Take a listen. First, on the question of the credibility of the information that violence was likely on January 6th.
I think we can agree that the FBI had credible information that there was likely to be violence on January 6th. Can we agree on that?
Well, I don't know that we had assessed its credibility. We certainly had information that was concerning about the potential for violence in connection with the January 6th events. And as we've discussed here this morning, one piece of information that was most specific that I'm aware of was passed
quite quickly. And then we know, for example, Mayor Muriel Bowser, who's the mayor of D.C., she tweeted out the day before, on January 5th, to be clear, the District of Columbia is not requesting other federal law enforcement personnel and discourages any additional deployment without immediate notification to and consultation with Metropolitan Police if such plans are underway, rejecting the offer that both Mark Meadows and President Trump had said was made to D.C. They rejected it. But we're still running cover for local officials, in addition to whatever the respective sergeants at arms in the House and Senate knew, what they passed on to Pelosi and McConnell, what Pelosi and McConnell sent back.
I would defer to others who were more involved in that discussion, but from what I have heard, what I have read, my understanding is that at one stage of the process, the local government was of the view that it did not need the National Guard's assistance.
Who do you mean by the local government? The mayor?
Yes.
The mayor.
No kidding. She tweeted it out
at the beginning.
What do you mean by the beginning?
Well, in the day or two leading up to the 6th. Okay. Then as to exactly how it played out on the 6th itself,
I understand,
you know, I'm not sure about.
I mean, clearly our people were overrun by the nut jobs. So we're making progress here, okay? So the mayor or the city government decided not to call out the FBI, the National Guard ahead of time. What about the House Sergeant-at-Arms?
I don't know what role the House Sergeant-at-Arms played with respect to the National Guard.
Okay.
You know, Christopher Wray doesn't know anything.
Right. It was
two months after this. He doesn't know anything other than what everybody knows who has followed this at all. Like I said, thanks for telling us about Muriel Bowser's tweet, Christopher Wray. I can look it up on Twitter just like you can. You're the FBI director. You're supposed to have some tools at your disposal that gets to the truth a little bit more quickly than, average citizen Joe like me can get to it. And you get nothing from him.
He's a big dum-dum. Honestly, I watched for a little bit and it was infuriating and I had to turn it off.
No, he's not a dum-dum. He's purposefully playing the role of a dum-dum, okay, which is worse. Joe in Franklin Park.
You know, we have to realize that one of their side plays are going to be going after all the lawful gun owners. They're going to outlaw guns. And one thing about these riots, the right does a very poor job of optics. You know, why don't we have a montage of all the Portland riots? Why don't we have a montage of all the kids crying when we throw away their Dr. Seuss books?
Thanks, Joe. All right.
Cassandra, that'll come later, yes.
Cassandra in Ravenswood.
Hi. I think that Christopher Wray is either incompetent, clueless, or as corrupt as James Comey. We've got the pictures and videos of BLM and Antifa buses. We've got the video from John Sullivan, Insurgents USA, shooting the Ashley Babbitt killing. We've got the video of him breaking the window. This is not a right-wing guy. And for Christopher Wray to stand up there, sit there, and refuse to answer these questions, I have less trust. It's hard to overstate how much less trust I have in the FBI than I did after James Comey. It's just frightening that these people are unwilling to go for the truth. This is frightening.
Thanks, Cassandra. I agree with you. Mm-hmm. Nathan in Fond du Lac.
Yeah, one of the things that I find with everything that you have been talking about is, as in the circle I run in, they refer to as the red-haired lady who does a daily indoctrination and theoretically answers no questions when questions are asked that are hard-lined to what this administration is doing. I would like to also know, why are they on the air? Is she on the air? Every day, this is socialism and/communism being forced down people's throats, because that is how you indoctrinate people, by repeated messages with the same answers and just repeating the same dogma. And nothing's ever said about it.
Thanks for the call, Nathan. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one, Chicago's Morning Answer, on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
I appreciate your program. It's the best in the morning in Chicago.
On AM 560.
I just heard the most sane 60 seconds of analysis I've ever heard on this issue, so.
Thank you.
Well done, brother.
The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy, and Dr. Seuss's, one of Dr. Seuss's stepdaughters, Theodore Geisel, his real name, has stepped up in response to the decision by Dr. Seuss Enterprises to stop publishing 6 Dr. Seuss books because they apparently contain insensitive imagery, according to some of the Jacobin educators and experts that were consulted by Dr. Seuss Enterprises or inflicted upon Dr. Seuss Enterprises and who they have succumbed to.
Well, it came out of a group of teachers in a school in Virginia who thought that was racist imagery. So they're the ones who started this all, because they banned the books from their school, and now they're not even going to publish them anymore.
Yeah, it's the Loudoun County School District. Loudoun County, you might remember, is where that father showed up for a school board meeting and told the his betters on the school board, the Imperial School Board there, to open the schools and figure it out, or he and his friends would replace them. I hope he and his friends move about replacing them through the electoral process. Lark Gray Diamond Cates said her late stepdad, said of her late stepdad, "There wasn't a racist bone in that man's body. He was so acutely aware of the world around him, and he cared so much." To she responding to the decision, although she also said this, "I think in this day and age, it's a wise decision. I think this is a world that right now is in pain, and we have all got to be very gentle and thoughtful and kind with one another. This is just very difficult times we live in."
Mm-hmm. Do you think her stepdad would appreciate that comment?
"We're taking that into account," you know, and she says, "we don't want to upset anybody." Mm-hmm. Well, she is a sculptor who has included sculptures of Dr. Seuss characters. She describes her dad as a sensitive, intelligent, and caring man who is a product of his times, as we all are. And yet he should be, these books should be, she thinks it's a wise decision that these books are no longer published. Does she write? I mean, it's her stepdaughter's perspective. You think this foments a kinder, gentler, to borrow a George H.W. Bushism, a kinder, gentler America? The elimination of these six books? The sensitivity that this conveys? The focus on not wanting to upset anybody? And the way that you don't upset anybody is just give in to who's ever upset? Is that how we should organize a free society? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. As she's talk about being a product of your times, his stepdaughter is, the stepdaughter that commented to the New York Post on what is being inflicted upon her stepfather.
I mean, she's so woke. She's so down with the struggle. You know?
She's a sentimentalist.
Exactly.
Sentimental barbarian, and there's so much of this.
I mean, and if you read, too, why they're not publishing some of the books, or six of the books, there was a study done by University of California at San Diego. They said most startling is a complete invisibility and absence of women and girls of color across Seuss's entire children's book collection.
Are you able to...
wow, how can we have that happen?
Yeah, I mean, again, this is the whole point, is anything that becomes popular has to be perfectly representative of the Western world, the world generally. If you leave any category of individual out, or you cast somebody of a particular demographic composition in a negative light, that somehow is reflective of your views on that entire population that has a similar demographic composition. This is the insanity of it all. It's the sentimentality of it all. There is no logic to it. You cannot follow the logic to any sensible ends. You can only follow it to absurd ends if you were to follow it at all, but you don't follow it. That's the whole point. You can't follow it. So what you do is you emote. You say, gosh, somebody's upset, so we should capitulate so they're not upset anymore.
Well that's it encourages bad behavior. They're going to be upset about something else next week.
Well, that's right. So now you've just told me what's the way to get my way. Pitch a fit. That's how we is that how we treat children? Is that how you raise your children? If the child pitches a fit over something, then you just indulge the child so that he or she no longer pitches a fit about that thing. Well, now you've just told the child that if you pitch a fit, you get what you want. And that's what we've done now as a culture with adults who are children, isn't it? One political figure who is taking an alternative view is, and speaking of Virginia, where this started, is a entrepreneur and now candidate, Republican candidate for governor in New Jersey, Virginia. Virginia's becoming indistinguishable from New right. Jersey in so many ways, at least Northern Virginia. His name is Pete Snyder, and he's giving away Dr. Seuss books. Listen to this ad he just posted.
Pete Snyder, conservative for governor of Virginia. "I do not like cancel culture in my house. I do not like it with a mouse. I do not like it in our schools. Why do we have to deal with these fools? Did you hear the latest? Not only are Loudoun County Public Schools closed, But these fools are actually trying to cancel Dr. Seuss instead of getting their schools back open. This is absurd. We need new leadership, and that's why I need to be the next governor of Virginia and need your help to do so. So if you donate $10 today, you'll get a signed copy of a Dr. Seuss book, not by the good doctor. Unfortunately, he's dead, and they're trying to cancel him now, but by me, your next governor of Virginia. Please donate today. Let's open up our schools and stop this cancel culture.
It's kind of sad when you bow before people who are upset such that you're willing to allow a characterization of your stepfather, who you apparently have some affection for, as is the case with Dr. Seuss's stepdaughter. You're willing to allow your stepfather to be slimed by the shame mafia. Isn't that sad?
312-642-5600. Turnkey.pro. Answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
I mean, you want it both ways. I can't imagine if, I mean, think about this for your own father or step parent. She says he didn't have a racist bone in his body. He was a caring, loving man, so on and so forth. She extols his work, but she says this is a wise decision. Well, what is going to win the day? What is going to win the day is indulging these shame extortionists. How can you let somebody that you care about be treated like that? Posthumously, no less, when they're not around to defend themselves. That's why you're here, to defend them and to set the record straight. I want to set the record straight, but I don't want to be, you know, too dogmatic about it. I mean, you can't. These are mutually exclusive. Either, you know, this he was a product of his times. That's sort of rationalizing. That sounds like rationalizing boorish conduct or content. And I think the argument is there is not boorish conduct or content here. So which is it? I would love to have his stepdaughter on the show to explore this with her. She's sort of a case study in what the problem is in America.
He's rolling over in his grave right now.
The problem in America, well, I have no idea. I mean, you know, by the way, Geisel, I'm thinking of Theodore Dreiser, Geisel's, you know, the Dr. Seuss stuff is like, it's not exactly conservative content from what I recall. It's been a while since I've read Dr. Seuss.
Oh,
but
come on, you read it to yourself last night as a nighttime story.
It doesn't strike me from the Dr. Seuss books as some conservative ideologue. But his stepdaughter, I mean, just understand this, the experts and the leftist education mafia that has moved to eliminate the publication of these books. Yes, they're a problem in America, but they're only a problem because of the attitude of people like Dr. Seuss's stepdaughter. Mark in Plainfield.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Was Fred Akes and Ham banned? Because I always found it a little bit racist that he never used Louisiana hot sauce on those eggs.
There you go.
No, no, let's ask just.
You do not like green eggs and ham? I do not like them. Sam, I am.
Good. Maybe Jesse Jackson can be canceled, too. At least that'd be a positive. Lee on the south side.
Yeah, you know, they're right in banning those books. In fact, we should take it a step further. There's something offensive in every book, so we should burn all the books. And if we find somebody that is hiding books in their house, maybe we should burn that house down and make sure they don't have any more hits.
Yeah, thank you, Ray Bradbury, Fahrenheit 451. I know. That's again, every dystopian novel that's ever been written is now coming true in the West.
If he's not a children's book author and a racist propagandist, then why aren't we banning all of his books? Just the six out of the, what, 50-plus that he's written?
I'm just a bit despondent over the fact that it's Dr. Seuss that gets people riled up, but banning Shakespeare, which has been going on for a couple of years now, nobody at the K-12 and post-secondary level, you know, barely registers. Robert in Bloomingdale.
Yep. Hey, how you doing this morning? This is just the beginning of cancel culture. Unless we stop it, this ridiculousness is just going to continue on and on and on. Thank you.
Thanks
well,
for the
I
call.
Told Peyton and Eli yesterday, I said, listen, they're going to take down 4 Abraham Lincoln statues. He freed slaves, by the way, in case they didn't know, but they knew. I said, and eventually they're going to change the name. We're not going to be the land of Lincoln. because he's going to be part of the cancel culture. So we're going to have a new, you know, theme. We're going to have new writing on our license plates.
A related story, upcoming video game dedicated to the Harry Potter book series will allow players to customize the character's physique and gender. In a Hogwarts Legacy, it will include the ability to give them masculine or feminine voice no matter what their body looks like. So to the extent that your kids are learning how the world works from video games instead of at school, or perhaps the video games are just reinforcing what they're learning at school, J.K. Rowling's position that biological sex matters is not going to be reflected in this Hogwarts Legacy game. So for your kids who are big Harry Potter fans and gamers, you can look for that trans-identitarian orthodoxy to be imposed upon them when they play video games in addition to when they go to the government school. Isn't that nice? Mm-hmm. Mm. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper, hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. We've talked about this for years, story after story after story. And at some point, the plural of anecdotes isn't data, but it provides an insight into directionally what's happening in an institution. Talking about academia here, just in the last week, the high-profile cases, and of course they represent just a sampling of what's happening. Jody Shaw, a Smith College graduate, drummed out of Smith, essentially. She went back to work there as an administrator. Drummed out of Smith because she has to spend all her time feeling bad about her whiteness and watching herself and others be subjected to false claims of racism on campus. We talked yesterday about a Princeton math professor who grew up under Ceausescu's communism in Romania, coming to the realization that STEM, so including his discipline, is no longer insulated from political ideology. And just coming to this recently, stunningly, but saying in his piece, in his op-ed that was posted at Barry Weiss's Substack page, that woke ideology is more of a threat to the academy, or is more really of a threat to civilization generally, than old-style Soviet communism. What a statement that is. If that doesn't send a chill down your spine, then you're unconscious from the neck up. We have John McWhorter, a noted linguistics professor from Columbia University, staying in the Ivy League, having to explain why there's no such thing as white math, and it is racist to suggest that black kids can't do math with precision, which is essentially the zeitgeist of pedagogy at the K through 12 and post-secondary level.
I'd be so offended.
So the Romanian professor from Princeton, math professor there, and John McWhorter are two sides of the same coin, arguing against the pernicious ideology that undermines the quality of instruction for kids pre-K through post-secondary. It is comprehensive. This is the gestalt of education in America today. And it continues almost unabated. For quantifying just how far gone higher education is, perhaps the data we need to continue to beat the drum, to decouple the BA from employment opportunities, as we talked about last week per Tony Esselin's piece, another guy who has spent his entire adult life in academia. We're pleased to be joined again by Eric Kaufman. He is a poli-sci professor at Birkbeck College at the University of London, and he is always at the ready with interesting survey information. Eric, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Great to be here, Dan.
So tell us about this new report that you did for the Center for the Study of Partisanship and Ideology about the state of thought in higher education in the West.
Yeah, so really this is, and some of you may have seen the Wall Street Journal piece that I did, which links to that new report. This is a sort of large report, 200 pages, but it's the largest data-based report on cancel culture and political discrimination in academia, focusing on the U.S., but also Canada and Britain. And really all the data and the surveys are telling the same story. Because so often when you bring up anecdotes like the one that you just did, opponents will say, oh, well, that's just a few incidents, and look, there are 500,000 people working in higher ed, and that doesn't mean anything. So it's very important, I think, to have this data. And what this shows is the high-profile stuff that the Jody Smiths of this world, that is the tip of the iceberg. That's what you see. What you don't see is actually a lot more important. And these are the chilling effects, the self-censorship. Just to give you a couple of numbers from the report, 7 in 10 conservative academics in the American universities that we surveyed said they self-censor in their teaching, research, or discussions.
And by the way, just sorry to interrupt, but 7 out of 10. You surveyed all 10 conservatives in academia. Congratulations.
Well, we didn't get many conservatives, but we did oversample a little bit with a sample from the National Association of Scholars, which is mainly conservative, but also a PhD student. So, I mean, we're getting the same kind of story here, high self-censorship. In Britain, it's 5 in 10. Canada, it's somewhere in the middle. The biggest problem is not, I mean, it is a problem that people are being no platform from speaking, but more than that, it's this chill effect, which means that conservatives are not asking certain questions because they know that they're not going to get published, they're not going to get hired, they're not going to get promoted, and we have data on the number of academics that would discriminate against a right-leaning grant application or promotion application, And another survey would be, or another question we asked was whether people would hire a known Trump supporter. 4 in 10 academics that we surveyed in the U.S. would not hire, were revealed not to hire a known Trump supporter. In Britain, it was about 1 in 3 wouldn't hire a known Brexit supporter. So we've got high levels of political discrimination. It's not the majority of academics, but it's close to. It's getting towards half. And in that kind of a climate of political discrimination, people are just going to self-censor to progress their careers and so that they can get along with their fellow colleagues. So it's not only the university punishing people, which is a huge problem, but it's also this sort of discrimination that goes on amongst academics.
Yeah, and I wonder if those numbers actually understate the pervasiveness of it, because obviously you're talking about people who are educated and they're supposed to take the position that, no, somebody's vote in a particular election shouldn't inform my hiring decision. So I know what the right answer is rather than my honest position. I just wonder, you know, what the delta is there.
Well, I actually think we use something called a list experiment, which gets at this very indirectly, and I think does give the correct number. So I do think that 4 in 10 is really about what it actually is. I guess you could say on the bottle half full that the 6 in 10 wouldn't discriminate against a known Trump support. That is good. I mean, there are some positive notes. One is that only 1 in 10 academics would tend to support firing a staff member who did research, controversial research on issues around race and gender. So there actually is only about 10% support for canceling controversial professors. But what's a bit disturbing is that the youngest academics under age 30 are twice as likely to support these cancellation campaigns those over 50.
Yeah, see, this is where it's going to, is one of the things that, you know, conservatives represent such a small fraction of academics to begin with. And as they, frankly, die off, who is replacing them? It's not going to be conservatives. This is the point that Peter Wood at National Association of Scholars and others have made, is that all the gatekeepers now are left. And so they're looking to, you know, hire fellow travelers in all of these disciplines, not hire those who have divergent opinions. And so the universe of dissent continues to shrink with each passing generation, with each passing hire.
Yeah, I think that's right, and there have been a number of studies. Mitchell Langberg also did a study which show in the social sciences and humanities now in the top 100 U.S. universities, it's something on the order of 12 on the left for everyone on the right. I got 14 to 1 in my U.S. and Canadian numbers. And what happens, actually, I also show in the report that at the master's level, if you go before you start a PhD, conservative master students are much more likely to say their views wouldn't fit in academia. So they're being repelled already at the master's level from an academic career. It's not because the academic career doesn't pay well. And so you're seeing this self-reproducing system of a political monoculture with maybe 5% conservative that is sort of putting off prospective conservatives from going into the profession. So you're self-reproducing a kind of monoculture. And it's not just that that's unjust and illiberal, but it's also leading to a damage to the entire scientific project. So, you know, we know low viewpoint diversity means certain questions don't get asked, certain arguments are never challenged, and so now we've started to see things like the replication crisis in psychology, where this groupthink has led many established findings to now, you know, be shown to be unreliable, because no one was, people just accept certain findings so readily when they accord with their prior views. And so the academy is not functioning properly in these disciplines.
Well, will those conservatives, a few conservative academics out there, do they self-censor in their teachings?
Yeah, there was a study that I think it was looking at legal scholars that showed that you know, coders couldn't, or people who were asked to judge people's output couldn't figure out who the conservatives were, whereas they could figure out who the liberals were, because the liberals were open in their writing about their views. Conservatives kept their views to themselves, or else they took on very technical subjects that were not controversial. So I don't think conservatives are going to go to zero. They're going to remain somewhere in the 5 to 10% perhaps. But they're going to have to be under deep cover for most of their careers, I think.
So it might as well be zero. Another interesting data point from your survey research, those who are comfortable sitting with fill in the blank, comfortable sitting with a Trump voting colleague, 41% would be comfortable sitting with a Trump voting colleague. So 6 in 10 would not. But even more uncomfortable than sitting with somebody who voted for Trump is the issue of gender politics.
Right, right. So somebody who is opposed to the idea of biological men entering a women's shelter as because they self-identify as a woman. So that kind of gender-critical feminist, we had only 28% of academics in the U.S. and in Canada saying they'd be comfortable sitting next to such a person. So that, well, I think...
I mean, yeah, I just need to stop there. One in four academics, higher education, 1 in 4 gatekeepers to, you know, the job market, effectively, 1 in 4 of those are not comfortable sitting with someone who believes that a man is a man and a woman is a woman, effectively based on biology. Only 1 in 4 would be comfortable sitting with someone who believes that.
Effectively, yes, and it's you know, the problem here is now, and what we've also seen, at least in Britain, on the data we have here, is that these gender critical feminists who make this argument about biological men not entering women's only spaces are the ones who are no platform the most, who face the most, you know, some of them have to go around with bodyguards. So, yeah, this is an incredibly intolerant climate.
I'm stunned by this, and I follow this closely. So for people who pay passing attention to this, it has to be shocking. And it has to, I would think, make parents around the country and the Western world question whether or not they should be sending their kids to colleges and universities, most of them at least around the country. Countries.
Well, I think, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, as we saw in the survey data, what you have is only about 10% of academics are actually pro-cancel, but a half of them are sort of torn between their kind of progressive commitments and their more liberal leanings, and so they're not willing to stand up to the cancelers, and that's kind of almost a bigger problem. It creates a permissive environment for these activists to function and to get their way. And ultimately, the only way this is tackled is going to be through external intervention. The university cannot, in my view, reform itself.
He is Eric Hoffman, a professor of politics at Birkbeck College, University of London, board member at the Center for the Study of Partisanship and Ideology. Do check out his report, or at least his op-ed in the Wall Street Journal, which I'll tweet out. Professor Kaufman, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Dan. Bye-bye.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, Joe Biden in the first Jobama term, in reaction to the bailouts post-2008-2009 Great Recession, infamously said we need to keep spending money to prevent from going bankrupt. Jobama's third term, which is at present, you have the same Joe Biden saying we need to spend $2 trillion in order to get America back to work. Well, it turns out the government spending in 2021 had the same anti-stimulative effect as the spending in 2009, 2010, or it will if this is codified into law. Study that was done by our friend Steve Moore and our other friend, University of Chicago economist Casey Mulligan, that is, excuse me, who I spoke with yesterday, actually. Really, really interesting. Just listen to this. I'll let Steve go over the top line data here, but this is so fascinating. Disincentives to work. How big are they? In Kansas, a family of four with two unemployed adults who had earned U.S. median wages, so say 55 grand.
All right.
A family of four with two unemployed adults who had earned U.S. median wages could get paid.
I'm ready.
Including the Biden add-on package, the after-tax equivalent of more than $135,000 on an annual basis without working an hour. In Massachusetts, where state unemployment benefits are the highest in the nation, the figure is $170,000. And that does not include any housing or rental assistance the family may also receive. The Biden package of benefits would exceed the wages and salaries of at least 85% of households. And they call that getting America back to work. Getting America on the dole for a little bit longer. It is not only anti-stimulative, it is pro-dependency, which is even worse. Because the longer you extend it, the more people get accustomed to it, don't they?
And they're buying Democratic votes.
That too.
In a sense.
For more on this, we're happy to talk to the lesser of the two who cobbled together this study. Steve Moore, Wall Street Journal economist, and Trumponomics author. I'm sure you would say that the same thing, Steve. Casey Mulligan is the real intellect here. You're the pretty face, and he's the guy who does all the green eye shades work.
It was my idea to do this study, and Casey, who really is amazing, he's one of the best economists in the country, really, chugged the numbers, and we were astounded. You know, I asked him, let's figure out how much a person could get, you know, in terms of all these benefits. Just so people know, people get normal unemployment benefits. By the way, I'm in favor of normal unemployment benefits. If people lose their job, especially in a pandemic, you don't want people to go hungry. We don't want people lose their homes and things like that. You provide them unemployment benefits, which are meant to give people an incentive to get back on the job and help them, when they lose their job. And so I said, we've been the normal unemployment benefits, plus $400 a week additional benefits. By the way, if you have two spouses and both of them are unemployed, so you double up, right? So it's times two. Then they have a rental assistance and mortgage insurance if you can't make your, meet your housing needs, your mortgage payments, your rental. Then they have expanded food stamps. And then if you read the Wall Street Journal last week, you know that they're now expanding Obamacare subsidies. You can be making over $200,000 a year and get Obamacare subsidies. Did you know that one, Dan?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Sure.
Yeah. So you add all this stuff up, and it turns out, and when I asked Casey to run the numbers, I thought, people could maybe make $50,000, $60,000, right? And that was a lot of money for not working. No, I was completely wrong. Not 50 to 60. You have in some states, and I bet in Illinois this is true, we haven't check the Illinois numbers, but I don't think they're too far from where Massachusetts is. You could actually have a couple on unemployment insurance and all the other benefits getting $150,000 a year for not working. I mean, is that insanity? And how are you going to get people back? What's going to happen here? mark my words, you heard it first on the Dan and Amy show. In 3 months, we're going to have, the economy is going to be booming. Once we get the vaccine out there, we're going to see the biggest recovery you ever saw. You're going to have businesses reopening. You know what problem they're going to have? They're not going to be able to get the workers back on the job.
Well, don't you think this is, you think this is why we have COVID enthusiasts? I mean, like, I can stay masked up and pretend like I'm scared of this virus.
Yeah.
You know, just like kids that could go back to school claim that, you know, they're fearful of the virus. No, they want to stay home and cheat on their homework, and they don't want to interact with teachers they don't like. And they don't have to get ready for school. Well, they can click in and roll back over. I mean, it's this whole, like, charade, this kabuki theater that's going on. And I just think it's not going to... So after this $1.9 trillion, we're going to have another one, too, after this?
You know, now they want to do another $1 trillion, quote, infrastructure bill. I mean, we could end up borrowing $5 trillion this year, but I want to make a point about what you just said about schools. So I did a whirlwind tour last week. I went to about 4 or 5 red states. And I think a lot of times when you're living in, like I live in the Washington, D.C. area, we're shut down. You guys live in Chicago area, you're shut down. So you feel like, oh, that must be the way the whole world is, right? Mm-hmm. With schools closed down and stores closed down and all sorts of restrictions on going to restaurants and things like that. I went to Texas, I went to North Carolina, I went to Arizona, and I went to Nebraska. Those states are open. I mean, it's normal. It's normal there. And I was really struck by this yesterday because I was in Omaha, Nebraska, and I was at a meeting, and right across the street was a school, and all the kids, the school bell rang at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. The kids are all running out. They're happy. They're running around. You know, these are, you know, 10 and 12 year old kids. And it's like, I haven't seen that in a year, but why in the world can't the school, if the schools in Nebraska are open, they've had no people getting sick, virtually none. I mean, some kids get the flu and things like that. That's just a normal thing. Almost no teachers have had problems. And yet in Illinois, here we are this is March. This is a year. And we mm-hmm. still have the school shut. What's your situation there?
K through 5 went back, and then 6 through 8th graders. No, 2 days a week. It's ridiculous. And then 8th graders go back next week, 6th through 8th graders. And high schoolers, they say they're going to think about it and have discussions, but we're not going back this year.
Well, that's Chicago. That's Chicago.
It is so absurd.
Yes.
Yeah, the message I wanted to relate to you is you're not normal there. And I mean, most states are back open. Most schools are back open. Why not Illinois? Why not New York? It's because you have bad leadership.
It's the unions.
It's more than the unions, isn't it, Steve? I mean, part of what we've seen happen over the last year as the data comes rolling in is the states haven't taken the hit in tax revenues that they projected they would. More modeling that was off. And many states haven't taken any hit whatsoever. In addition to that, many families haven't taken any hit. In fact, they've seen their household income go up because of all of the government funny money.
Yeah, right. And that's created this illusion of prosperity. But you know, the thing that was interesting about going to these red states was that people in those states are happy. They're happy. The kids are happy that people, you know, when I go to New York, Illinois, I mean, people are grimacing, you know, they're angry, you know, and why not? They haven't been able to get out and do things. And it's really almost a cultural change when you move to this. I mean, Florida, I'm going to Florida tomorrow. Florida's completely open for business. The only way you'd even know that there's a pandemic is that people do social distance and they do wear masks. But life goes on. The beaches are open. The schools are open. The restaurants are open. The bars are open. And again, I just keep asking this question. By the way, Florida has a lower death rate than Illinois does. So somebody explain to me why we're shutting down everything.
So with respect to the $1.9 trillion, which is pending, give us your take on what this would mean at macro level per the research that you and Casey Mulligan did, because I don't want to overstate the case because there's never a need to overstate the case when it comes to leftist policy. You just have to state the case. The benefit levels we just talked about. And this is not to say, you know, people find more satisfaction than just monetary satisfaction from working. So people will still go back to work. But what it will be, I think, and I think this your study confirms this, is the same thing we saw coming out of the Great Recession, that the wild government spending actually inhibits the recovery, inhibits people going back to work. So they ultimately will. But as long as they can make it make more sense to not work than to work, they will as well.
Well, so you don't even have to go back to the Great Recession. We saw this, remember, late last summer when the virus went into a kind of remission. And so things got opened up again around the country for a few months. And you had this situation, which you're going to see in April, May, and June of this year, which is you had businesses opening up. You still had 20 million unemployed people, Dan. But guess what? Everywhere you went, you saw help wanted signs. So what I'm telling you, I mean, I guarantee this is going to happen in Illinois and Massachusetts and New York and every state around the country. You're going to have businesses reopening, and they're not going to be able to get the workers back on the job. And the liberals here in Washington, they, oh, well, that's okay. They could just pay these people $25 or $30 an hour, and they'll get them back on the job. That's part of their, you know, they're forcing businesses to raise their wages. What these people, these politicians don't understand, because they've never run a business, that's why they're politicians. The small business can't afford to do that. Walmart may be able to afford to do it. Target may be able to afford to do it. Goldman Sachs may be able to do it, but not a small business with four or five employees. They don't have the revenues to be able to jack up their prices and their wages. And so you're going to have a big, big problem. It's going to kill small businesses.
So one of the things that we may see coming out of this, you know, I know there's all this exuberance for economies to reopen, and everybody's celebrating Texas and Mississippi's announcements yesterday. But we may find that most of us underestimated the damage we inflicted on ourselves. And so we may not see the sort of recovery that we thought. In point of fact, things may be a lot worse trying to recuperate than anticipated by many.
So my prediction is, I have a slightly different take on it, not entirely though. I think the rest of this year is going to be blockbuster. I mean, it's going to be blowout. We're going to see huge growth. People haven't been able to get out for, you know, 10 months. They haven't been able to travel. They haven't been able to go to movies. They haven't been able to restaurants. So I do think the second half of this year is going to be awesome. And it's not because of Biden's policies. Because of the vaccine. What troubles me, Dan, is I think 2022, 23, I mean, the cost of this is going to be felt for years and years and decades. Mm-hmm. Decades. Mm-hmm. I mean, decades. Seriously. I mean, our grandkids are going to pay for this, for this stupid $2 trillion spending bill, which, by the way, 22 governors said they don't want the money. Did you see that?
Yeah.
22 governors. I mean, we're giving people money and they don't even want it. That's how crazy it is in Washington these days, folks.
Well, I mean, Steve, so speak to this a little bit more, because I agree with you. And you know, there's a lot of concern right now, even within the industry, and this is an industry that's known for, you know, propagandizing exuberance, the real estate industry, particularly residential, because of these housing markets that are on fire. But people are over exuberant about a stock market that continues to go up with really no reason other than being other than modern monetary theory. And the increasing household incomes, which you just said sort of fleeting enrichment. And so they're buying homes $100,000 more than maybe they should be, for example, buying $100,000 more homes. So in a sense, we see a bubble being reblown up and very few lessons learned from the Great Recession.
Right. I agree with you entirely. We are building up a bubble economy. You know, I if you ask people, what do you think about this stimulus bill? I was sort of demoralized. I mean, I think the approval rating for this bill is like 60%. Well, why is that? Well, you know, if you come knocking on my door and say, do you want $2,000? Sure. You know, yeah, wonderful. How about $3,000, $4,000, $5,000? Of course people want free money. And we're all acting. I'm kind of depressed that Americans are buying into this, that, gee, we can just have helicopters drop money out of the windows and everybody's going to get rich. And that's why a lot of people say they support this bill, because they think, gee, yeah, sure, I'd love $2,000. It's like winning the lottery, right? But you have to. You know, as Milton Friedman taught us, you know, the government can only give you, Dan Prop, $1,000 by taking $1,000 from me. There's not some kind of pixie dust out there. And so I do think you're seeing an irrational exuberance. You're seeing a massive increase in spending this year. But boy, we should have learned this lesson. When it crashes, it crashes. One other quick thing. I have three very good friends who are major donors to my group that are very, very wealthy, and they all live in Illinois. And all three of them, within the last 6 weeks, have called me and said, I bought a place in Naples. I bought a place in Palm Beach. I bought a place in Fort Lauderdale. I bought a place in Vero Beach. That you in Florida right now, you can't buy a house. You have to. The real estate agents are literally knocking on people's doors in Florida saying, would you sell your house? There is no inventory left. That the exodus out of Illinois, Massachusetts, New York, Connecticut is something I've never seen before, and it's accelerating. It's accelerating. Illinois better get its finances in order, better get those taxes down, get serious about competitiveness, or that state is going down the drain. You're losing your most productive job creators in the state. I mean, I think, why aren't the alarms going off?
Steve Moore, economist, Wall Street Journal columnist, Trumponomics author. Steve, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Okay, guys. Stay safe. Bye.
Thanks. Stay sane. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. I always thought that William F. Buckley's famous observation that National Review was standing athwart history yelling stop, and that was sort of the defining statement of conservatism of the Buckley era, was wildly misinterpreted, and purposefully in many quarters, as somehow wanting to freeze America in 1955. And that was never the case, or that conservatism wants to go back to stylized notion of the Ozzie and Harriet America. That's not the case either. The case for conservatism is conserving the good in terms of policies consistent with fundamental principles, the truth that endures through the ages, rather than indulging the hubris of thinking we're going to remake the world anew. It was the same Bill Buckley who said of the left in criticism, they seek to immanentize the eschaton, in other words, create heaven on earth, which is man's folly, and which we see playing out in real time in all sorts of bright and disturbing colors, don't we? So conservatism with Trump, and as we talked about a little bit yesterday, with Gen Xer Trump supporters ascendant, governors like Noem in South Dakota and DeSantis in Texas, what does that look like? For more on this discussion, we're pleased to be joined by Peter Berkowitz, senior fellow at the Hoover Institution and former director of policy planning at the State Department. He's written a piece you can find over at realclearpolitics.com, which I'll tweet out, Crisis, Resilience, and American Conservatism. Peter, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
It's good to be with you. Thank you.
So you tackled some of the Buckley era lessons combined with some of the observations and recommendations of sort of a new generation of conservatives like Orrin Cass. What is your prescription for where conservatism finds itself in this post-Trump, but still Trump, that oxymoron makes sense, era?
Well, I guess my first prescription is to take seriously the circumstances of the moment, but also understand the history of the conservative movement. And unfortunately, most people don't begin with the history of the conservative movement, as you just did, recognizing the very common sense idea that conservatism is about conserving, which raises the next question, what is it that you wish to conserve? And you're quite right about people misunderstanding what Buckley meant by standing athwart history, yelling, stop. Buckley especially wanted to conserve two sets of ideas that have been crucial to the United States. One is the principles of freedom that are embodied in our constitutional order. And second, the traditional moral practices, family and community that it's sustained freedom. People say today that, well, after Donald Trump, conservatism is fundamentally different. I don't believe it's fundamentally different. I believe that, we need to devise, we need to strike a new balance between conserving the principles of freedom, traditional morality, and on this matter, Orrin Cass is right, it seems to me, we need to pay special attention to these days, to the needs and discontents of those people, our working class especially, that's been especially hard hit by globalization.
Well, so that rebalancing then, because one might argue that, and many are, but more of a libertarian variety, that so much of the disaffection that gave rise to Trump was the result of expansionist government, including under Republican administrations, ostensibly conservative leadership, not the lack thereof.
And I think they would be right. Many of the discontents are as a result of an overgrown, in some respects, dysfunctional government. But not all the problems are a result of an overgrown and dysfunctional government. And our own constitutional tradition teaches us that we need a government to be energetic and competent in its appropriate spheres. It's inevitably taken on more responsibilities by 2021 than it had in 1790. That's true. But here, too, we need to strike the balance. We cannot speak, it's not realistic to speak about a government that gets out of the business of regulation. We need a government that regulates within limits and does it competently, responsibility, understanding, for example, the real challenges that arise from our strategic competitors abroad, number one of which is China.
Well, but here's the form this is taking, though, in one respect. Tom Cotton and Mitt Romney say, in response to the push for a $15 federal minimum wage, we'll give you a $10 federal minimum wage if you give us some border enforcement. The response to child tax credits is for Mitt Romney to propose, and I go back to Mitt Romney again, but he represents some school of thought on center-right, the tiny wing that he describes of the party, but nonetheless, it certainly hits above its weight because of the adoration of the press corps for the Mitt Romneys of the world. He is talking about a precedent-setting direct payment to American families based on the number of children they have, rather than just the child tax credits that have historically been sort of the push for family-friendly policies from conservative ranks. I mean, these are real paradigm-shifting positions that start from the premises of the left. And so if you're going to continue to expand government, but you're saying, I'm going to use government for my direction, then you're conceding the point to the left to use government for their direction, and government grows, which is actually what we've seen since the Buckley era. No matter who's in charge, one thing you can count on is government growth.
Well, I think that's for sure correct. All the data is clear, and certainly including 1981 to 1989, when Ronald Reagan was president, government grew. And there are a variety of reasons for that, having to do with changes in American society, but also having to do sometimes with conservatives being asleep at the watch. But here's the thing, it seems to me at least. Reasonably speaking, we can't expect government to stop growing. What we can do, though, and this is quite reasonable and this is conservative, is at least slow down the rate at which it grows and to make sure that government is operating within constitutional limits. You know, it's interesting. Our founders didn't speak about small government, although they had a very small government. Their phrase was limited government. So it seems to me what conservatives need to be concentrating on now, and believe me, I'm as worried as you are about runaway overreaching and competent government. But we need to be thinking about the principled limits beyond which government is really just is engaging in activities for which it has no constitutional warrant and no real competence. And compromises are another matter.
Well, what about the oil spot technique approach to conservatism. In other words, starting from a position of strength and radiating out from that position of strength, focusing perhaps arguably the limited resources conservatism has right now culturally in areas that present the biggest opportunity. And one of them, particularly coming out of the pandemic, seems to me K-12 education, really pre-K through post-secondary education, and a promotion of school choice at the pre-K through secondary level, and a promotion of decoupling the BA from the job market at the post-secondary level. There's got to be something that animates conservatism other than just the willingness, like Trump did, to take on all of the horribles on the left. And it seems to me maybe, I'm just throwing this out as one example, maybe the education arena where so much attention is now focused because of everything that's transpired, maybe that's the place conservatism should marshal all their troops.
Well, I certainly agree that conservatives should marshal a lot of troops in the education sphere, and they have been since for decades now. School choice, voucher systems has been a conservative idea. And by the way, it ought to appeal to both of the main types of conservatives, classical liberal, libertarian, limited government conservative. Conservatives should appreciate this because it limits the role of government. Traditional those conservatives who want to preserve traditional morality should appreciate it because it gives families and localities more control over education. Here seems to me is another area where conservatives can press. We can make new laws. We can restrict laws that have prevented the development of nuclear power as a support for generating electricity in the United States. Technology has advanced extraordinarily in the last three decades. Nuclear powered energy, nuclear reactors producing energy are safe. It's impossible for them to cause the kinds of meltdowns that were made famous in movies from the 1980s. This would be a great way to produce reliable, affordable, safe, and secure energy, and clean energy to boot, entirely consistent with conservative principles.
Maybe one other area, and this is taking, you know, perhaps one step back from education, but leading into it, in addition to energy policies you're describing with respect to our economic vitality, is what President Trump and Josh Hawley and Ted Cruz and others have really tried to raise the profile on, which is unrelenting defense of freedom of speech and freedom of thought, our First Amendment protections, all of them, actually, including freedom of conscience, and really presenting the choice to Americans between people who are believers in those First Amendment rights and those big tech overlords who are not particularly unpopular and, frankly, across the political spectrum for different reasons. Maybe that's a beachhead, and then you go to education, and then you go to energy policy. I mean, I know you have to run parallel tracks, but it seems to me that you also have to decide where limited resources should be most expended, you know, highest, best use, consistent with conservative economic principles.
That seems right to me, and we can put it this way. Conservatives are at their strongest when they're conserving fundamental constitutional principles. The few principles that are as fundamental to our Constitution as individual freedom, human equality, the apolitical expression of that is the protection that the Constitution gives to freedom of speech. Yes, I would like to see even more the powers of the federal government, limited powers of the federal government, marshaled in defense of free speech. Now, that requires tricky legislation and tricky executive action because we're talking about the use of government to accomplish something. Remember, freedom of speech in the Constitution is essentially a limitation on congressional action. Mm-hmm. Right? Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech. And yet, I just put this from a constitutional point of view, having robust public debate is an essential expression of our freedom and essential to the vitality of the United States. It lets us continue to be innovative. And by the way, it allows different families and communities to pursue the good as they understand it. So, yes, for sure, we can get there are opportunities in education, opportunities in energy, and opportunity in the defense of freedom of speech, an essential constitutional principle.
He is Peter Berkowitz, senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, former director of policy planning at the State Department. Peter, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, the reason Illinois is so lost is because of what's happened to communities like Naperville. We spend a lot of time talking about Chicago, perhaps not enough time talking about suburban communities like Naperville. And since they're so prone to shaming all those mail impersonators, those Grant Worley Republicans, those ghastly Tina Fey housewives in Naperville, they'll be properly shamed by 8th grader Jake Deason, who showed up to comment at a recent Naperville School District 204 board meeting on behalf of all the adults who were frozen out of the meeting and literally freezing outside because the school board only allowed 50 people in the room.
This number 50's got to stop too, but we'll get to that.
This is so good. Jake Deason, eighth grader in Naperville, who has more stones than most of the men, so-called men in that community. Yeah. Feel free to call in if you want to prove me wrong.
Hello, my name is Jade Egan, and I am an eighth grader at Kennedy Junior High. At the November board meeting, I shared with you how I was frustrated with e-learning following the implementation of the block schedule. Today, I plan to speak about that again and how I didn't agree with the block schedule, how I didn't agree with the hybrid plan, and how I wanted to be in full-time 5 days a week. But then, when I came here, I saw that you guys were not letting everybody in who were standing outside. And about halfway through this, when I was waiting, I thought, you know what, I should revise my speech. So, you know, I just thought about it all in my head. And I remember in about 2011-ish, when you guys were redrawing the boundaries, you guys had the board meeting for the big one in the auditorium right over there, where I think there's over 2,500 people capacity, okay? And I don't understand why you cannot do this when redrawing boundaries is minuscule compared to the risk of child's education and people being back in school. So I have two options. I'm going to recommend to you guys next meeting, you guys should go out either in that massive stadium right there if you guys are afraid about COVID, because by then the temps will warm up. There's a nice sound system there. Or you can go in the auditorium. Putting people in a mid-sized room, okay, with only 25 capacity and not letting people's voices be heard is horrible. You are silencing our freedom of speech. You are silencing the Open Meetings Act by not letting anybody who wants to come in here. The person over there, the man, he said, oh, when one person leaves, another person can come in. Then they just reversed that. You called the cops on people who wanted to speak and who wanted to tell you that you guys are doing a horrible job and you are putting our education at risk. You know what? I thought I put trust in you guys at the beginning. And now I just see that you guys are just a sham of a school board. I hope you guys don't get reelected at all. And I hope Dan Bridges, I hope you resign.
Oh. On behalf of the whole board, thank you for your comments, Jim.
Yeah, on behalf of the whole board, thank you for your comments.
Now leave.
I pulled in Amy Jacobs, and I misheard his name the first time Amos asked her, Jay Deegan. I want to get his name right because he should be a one-man school board in Naperville 204. How pathetic are the adults, most of them, in Naperville, that you have to have an eighth grader do your dirty work for you? Thankfully, this is perhaps the most well-spoken eighth grader this side of the Mississippi. How wonderful is that? So, I'm sorry, the men in Naperville, the moms and dads in Naperville, what do you have to say to Jay Deegan? And I know there are some moms and dads that feel the same way, and that during comment section, the comment section said similar things. But for the most part, that's not the majority, is it, in Naperville? Otherwise, the school still wouldn't be closed, effectively.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Get your tickets for Biden, the first 100 days on March 20th. Tickets are on sale now at 560theanswer.com/Biden.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Just one more comment on that eighth grader from Naperville we played before Mike Scott's newscast. I want to also compliment his parents, Jay Deegan's parents, for raising such a thoughtful and brave kid, because I know that is not the product of the schools in Naperville.
Right, and you have to be brave to do what he did. There's no doubt.
And the great thing about his bravery is how sharply it contrasts from the abject cowardice of so many of those suburban parents. You know who I'm talking about when I say you are pathetic and embarrassing and your conduct has been shameful. Shameful. And if anybody has the guts to call in and discuss that, who disagrees with me, please do. I will give you the floor, but I know that's unlikely to be the case because of what I just described being accurate. Switching gears, we're pleased to be joined now by George Perry, former federal and state prosecutor out of Philadelphia, blogs at knowledgeisgood.net. And if you thought things were locked down in D.C., if you thought that looked like a militarized zone, you should see the area around the Hennepin County Courthouse in Minnesota in advance of jury selection and the Derek Chauvin trial, which jury selection begins next week.
Yeah,
George, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Great to be with you.
Tell us a little bit about what you anticipate in the Derek Chauvin trial. And again, for those who've forgotten, this is the officer who had his knee on the neck of George Floyd and is on trial for murder.
Well, right now, according to news reports, the area around the Hennepin County Courthouse looks like a war zone. They've erected parallel barriers, concrete barriers topped with fencing with razor wire in between all around the Hennepin County Courthouse. They fortified the county jail, which is several blocks away, and they're fortifying police precincts throughout the city, and they've got the Minnesota National Guard coming in to conduct patrols to provide a presence and a deterrence, in the words of officialdom, in key business corridors. And there are other preparations that are going on there. The city is hiring so-called influencers to quell rumors about the trial and so forth and so on. All of this in anticipation of the trial of former officer Derek Chauvin, who is being scheduled for jury selection on March 8th. And the mayor has said that the obvious flashpoint in all of this will be around the time of deliberations and the jury verdict. And what the mayor is anticipating, and correctly anticipating, is if there is an acquittal of Officer Chauvin, Minneapolis is going to explode. And the point that I made in my article in the American Spectator is, under these circumstances, how in the world can a fair and impartial and unintimidated jury be selected in Hennepin County to hear the case of Derek Chauvin, when they know, when anybody on that jury knows, if they vote for an acquittal, the whole city is going to blow up, and any juror voting for acquittal is going to become a target of the very same mob violence. So,
well, it won't just be that city either.
It'll be the whole country. It'll be Chicago again. It'll be New York. It'll be L.A. So there's a lot of pressure. Now, didn't his defense attorneys try to get the trial moved out of Hennepin County?
Yeah, and what's happened, that motion for change of venue so far has been denied, but I can tell you just based on my own experience in dealing with messy cases like this, what could very well happen here is they'll try and pick a jury, and if they can't get a jury, because in highly contentious cases like this, the tendency is, you know, people will just say, look, I don't want to be on the jury. I can't be fair. You know, the judge will then grant the change of venue to a remote location where they stand a better chance of finding jurors. But right now, the case is going forward in Hennepin County. And according to the local news media, the city of Minneapolis looks like a war zone right now. So that's where we're at.
And I want to be clear, obviously, you're a former federal and state prosecutor, so obviously this is not a defense of Derek Chauvin you're offering. This is a desire to see, our justice system work. And if you can't impanel an objective jury, then our justice system isn't working the way it's intended to. That's the concern here. It's not a concern over Derek Chauvin's guilt or innocence. It's a concern over a fair trial.
Well, it's concern over a fair trial, but make no mistake, I've I have reviewed the evidence in this case, and I've written a number of articles about it. And I'm telling you right now, Derek Chauvin, none of those police officers, including Derek Chauvin, caused the death of George Floyd. And one of the most telling things that's happened in the lead up to this trial is the defense moved to have the trial televised. And the prosecution has vigorously opposed that motion. The judge granted the motion, and the prosecution asked the judge to reconsider his decision, which raises the question of why doesn't the prosecution want the world to see the evidence as it is developed in the courtroom? And my take on it is because once all of the evidence comes out, not just the highly edited and selective video that everybody has seen, when all of the evidence comes out, it's going to become perfectly clear that Chauvin and the other officers did not kill George Floyd.
That's well, what was the cause of death? Right.
Yeah, lay out your case.
What did the ME report
okay,
say?
Okay, the cause of death comes down to this. If you look at the whole video, not just the stuff that's been broadcast, Floyd begins shouting that he can't breathe while he's still upright and mobile. Before he's on the ground, he's saying, I can't breathe, I can't breathe. And the police treated him with a great deal of consideration. They're trying to get him into the patrol car. And he's saying, he's basically, I'm claustrophobic. I'll die in there. Don't put me in the car. So they're saying things to him like, we'll roll down the window. We'll turn on the air conditioning. I mean, I compare that to the Philly cops of 30 years ago. They just would have hit him over the head and thrown him in a wagon. But these guys are being very solicitous. So then you get to the cause of death. He couldn't breathe while he was still standing up. He was upright and mobile because, as they found at autopsy, his lungs were filled with fluid. And why were his lungs filled with fluid? Because he had taken a massive overdose of fentanyl. And fentanyl causes pulmonary edema, which is fluid in the lungs, and it also suppresses respiration. So Floyd expires while he's on the ground. How did he get to be on the ground? Because he asked to be put on the ground. And Derek Chauvin's knee on the side of his neck did not occlude his airway. And the Hennepin County Medical Examiner has told the FBI in another piece of evidence that was hidden by the prosecution until recently, when he was interviewed by the FBI, the Hennepin County Medical Examiner said, Chauvin did not occlude Floyd's airway by kneeling on the side of his neck. I mean, I could go into all the weeds of this, but those are the basic facts. What killed Floyd was a drug overdose that caused his lungs to fill up with fluid.
And he also had COVID.
And the question, though, of Derek Chauvin having the knee on the neck for some 8 minutes, that's not an open question in your mind in terms of that being a contributing factor, even with that underlying condition?
It's going to be a factor because my good friend, Dr. Michael Bodden, the celebrity pathologist, former chief medical examiner of the city of New York, is going to testify that kneeling on the side of the neck impeded the flow of blood to the brain. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be an open issue. And what's going to happen at the trial, though, is you're basically going to have dueling medical examiners. You're going to have the Hennepin County medical examiner saying, as he said in the FBI report, what killed Floyd was his bad heart, his poor health situation, and the struggle that he had with the police before he was on the ground. I mean, that's in his FBI 302.
But Biden
is going to testify that once he was on the ground, when Chauvin is kneeling on the side of his neck, that occluded the flow of blood through the carotid arteries to Floyd's brain. And I think that's a very problematic take on the thing. But look, I have to, in interest of full disclosure, I've known Dr. Bodden for 35 years. We're actually friends. I've used him as a witness in both my prosecution and defense cases. He's a terrific witness, and he's a very smart man. So there's going to be that issue in the case.
Well, right. And it seems to me, if I'm a prosecutor, I argue that at minimum, he Chauvin violated police procedure. He was not attendant to George Floyd when he was still protesting, while he was essentially docile with his knee on his neck. And that showed a reckless disregard for human life. And so there's your at least second degree murder conviction.
Well, you can make that argument, but one of the ironies here is that the knee on the side of the neck was an approved restraint that was taught at the Minneapolis Police Academy for many years. They stopped using it before Floyd's death, but the fact of the matter is, if you look in the training materials that were still being used at the time of Floyd's death, is they got a picture of a cop kneeling on the side of someone's neck. I mean, that was an approved technique that undoubtedly Chauvin learned that at the police academy. It wasn't something he invented on the scene.
But you've got that issue. But you still have the issue of, as you said, he's George Floyd saying, "I can't breathe," while they're trying to get him into the squad car initially. And then he's still saying it when he's on the ground. And so a prosecutor would argue, well, you were notified essentially by the person you were trying to detain that he was having trouble breathing. You were trying to call a paramedic for a medical response, and then you have him on the ground. So, you know, you reasonably should have known that that extended period of time with a knee on your neck could cause injury, if not death. And so, again, you get back to the same place if I'm the prosecutor arguing on behalf of the state.
Oh, yeah. Look, I can make out the prosecution case, but what I'm saying is there is reasonable doubt based on the physical evidence and the video, the full video record. There is certainly reasonable doubt as to whether or not the police caused the death of George Floyd, and it's the burden of the prosecution to prove their case beyond a reasonable doubt.
Right.
But the main point of my article was that before a fair and impartial jury, Derek Chauvin's got more than a fighting chance of an acquittal, but they're not going to be able to find a fair and impartial jury in Hennepin County, and certainly they're not going to be able to find a fair and impartial jury that is unintimidated and free of the fear of mob retaliation against the jury itself or the jurors who vote for acquittal. So the best they could do under these circumstances, it seems to me, is to get this case out of Hennepin County, which has already had a great deal of rioting and disruption in the immediate wake of Floyd's death, and is now preparing for World War III in the event that there's an acquittal. They need to get the case out of there and get it to one of the outlying counties that hasn't previously been destroyed by rioting and the kind of mob intimidation that has been going on in Hennepin County ever since Floyd's death.
Although
if
they had it outside Hennepin County, if they had it outside Hennepin County and he was acquitted outside of Hennepin County, that would inflame the passions perhaps even more, wouldn't it? You took it out of Hennepin County to get him acquitted rather than have him be tried in the jurisdiction in which the alleged crime occurred.
Look, whatever happens here, all I can tell you is if there is an acquittal, you know, there's going to be an explosion. There's going to be an explosion, and it's going to this will all continue to be exploited by Black Lives Matter and Antifa and whoever else as part of their anti-police narrative. But just viewing it as a trial advocate, the lawyers representing Derek Chauvin, they have to be concerned with the interest of their client. And I think that they're fully justified in arguing that there is reasonable doubt in this case and that it really needs to be heard by a fair, impartial, and unintimidated jury somewhere else outside of Hennepin County.
He is George Perry, former federal and state prosecutor. He blogs at knowledgeisgood.net. George, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Okay, great to be with you.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.